Friends, you're listening to Irish Radio Network USA, and right now we are going to take our microphones to Belfast. No, not Belfast, Ireland. Belfast, Maine, where hopefully we are linking up with Catherine Miles, who is a professor of environmental writing at Unity College, the author of Adventures with Ari, tons of articles that have appeared in publications, including Best American Essays. She lives and sails in Belfast, Maine. Her new book is All Standing, which was only released in the last week or so. Let me welcome, indeed, to our program, Catherine Miles. How are you, Catherine?
Hi, thanks so much for having me. I'm well.
Okay. Now, apart from the fact that you have a flu and that it's 0 degrees up there and hence you're not live in our studio, but let me ask you a little bit about yourself and how you got involved in the story of the Jeannie Johnston tall ship and indeed the Famine Museum.
Well, the Jeannie Johnston is a remarkable story, which I'm sure many of your listeners are familiar with. And I had the good fortune of meeting the recreation of the ship when it was in actually the other Belfast, Ireland. I was over there doing some research for a different project. And it's such a remarkable ship, and it's the kind of vessel that just stops traffic wherever it goes. And so I went down to the docks and learned a little bit about the ship and its remarkable history. And from that point on, I was hooked and dedicated myself to trying to do as much research on its history and the history of those involved as I could.
Right. Now, it sailed between Tralee in County Kerry and North America, and that actually that happened in 1847, the infamous year of the potato famine, and actually continued until 1855. Tell us about the passengers, those who, if I remember correctly, about a million people fled Ireland during that period, and indeed there are many stories that are aptly referred to about the coffin ships, and I think maybe we should dwell on that for a moment before we get to the Jeannie Johnston, which in fact never lost a passenger. In your own research, what did you find with respect to the coffin ships, the ships that actually took people to North America, to Canada and the United States?
There were about 5,000 of these ships, actually, and most of them were very tired, old timber haulers, and they were part of a triangle trade that was really remarkably similar to the triangle trade that was driven by the slave trade in the decade generations prior. And in this case, these timber ships were taking timber from North America, largely Canada and New England, and they were bringing timber by the hundreds of acres down to the Caribbean, where it was being used to refine cane sugars down into molasses and then ultimately rum. And then it would carry those products up to England. And then there was this largely empty leg on the triangle trade, and for the most part, prior to the famine, ship crews were having to load ballast of stone or sand onto these ships to make them stable enough for their passage through the North Atlantic. And if you look at some of the buildings in places like Quebec and Montreal, you'll see that they're in fact built with stone from places like Ireland, Scotland, and Northern England. But the stone was very cumbersome. It was heavy to load. It would move around and would sometimes crack hulls. And then you obviously had to carry it off the ship when you landed at port in North America. So when the famine hit in 1847, both the ship owners and the British government saw in it the solution to what they saw as multiple problems, one being that empty leg in the trade. More insidious, I think, perhaps, is what they saw as the need to populate Canada so that it would be more fortified against a potential American invasion. And then a really strong desire to clear the land in Ireland so that it could be converted from subsistence farming to what we now know is industrial agriculture. So when the famine hit and there were so many people suffering from starvation and mass pandemics, including the flu, typhus, cholera, the idea very quickly became to get them as paying passengers onto the ships. The problem, of course, is that these ships were not built to carry passengers. Most of them were very old. They were not seaworthy. And what they would do is try to load these starving Irish people onto the ship almost like timber. They would build these very crude bunks, 2 and 3 stories tall, and people would be packed in so tightly that they couldn't even sit up. There were no facilities on board. And unlike the previous generation's slave ship captains, who were paid by the number of slaves that stepped off alive when they reached North America, these ship captains would receive payment for the Irish, but then what became of them was of no one's concern, ultimately. And so while we don't know the precise mortality rates on these ships, we do know that many of them had rates that were anywhere between 25 and 75% of people lost on every single trip.
Incredible, and indeed a conservative estimate. Would say that for those who were fleeing the land of starvation and disease, more than 100,000 never made it to North America at all, and that's you know, incredible just to imagine. That first of all, to somehow get the passage money together, and then know as you were boarding that ship that your likelihood of making North America was so poor that for many of them, they were actually, it wasn't inappropriate to refer to them as coffin ships in the first place. They had to know that. They did know that. Yeah.
News spread very quickly about the condition of these ships, and I think it's a real testament to how terrible the conditions were in Ireland, and also how strong and how willing to risk their lives on a new future so many of these struggling Irish people were. And in researching that and coming across these stories of people willing, as you say, to stake their lives and the lives of their families on the chance to begin again in North America was an incredibly moving and humbling experience.
Right. Now, who organized all of these ships and how many of them would have left from Tralee, say, opposed to many other ports? Including, obviously, Cove.
That's a complicated question. And in my research, what I found was multiple attempts by the British government to pay for the passage of these immigrants. And that had been a very popular political decision that had been made during the late 18th century when people from mostly the Scots-Irish were, in fact, subsidized by the government to come over. And in places like my town in Belfast, Maine, was, in fact, settled by these people who had passage paid by the British government. But by the time the famine hit, the idea of supporting the Irish had become incredibly unpopular among the English people. And so while there were a few attempts to pay for the passage by British governmental subsidy, those were largely shot down by the voting British. And so what we saw was a combination of passengers who would take their entire life savings for the chance to send one member of the family over with the hopes that that person might be able to make largely his way enough that he would be able to send for family members a wife or a child or a father or a mother. And then in some cases, you also see the landlords themselves paying to remove their tenants. They saw that as the path of least resistance to convert their farmland over to more profitable either animal husbandry operations or large-scale grain production.
Let me ask you about those who died on board. What happened and how are the bodies disposed of?
It depended a great deal from ship to ship, but when they were at sea, if they were on a ship that had a benevolent crew, people who died, and they were dying not only of starvation, but also in many cases of typhus and cholera, if they died, they would be taken above deck. They'd be wrapped in old sailcloth if that was available. There might be a brief service. If it was a very benevolent captain, he might officiate a service, and then the body would be launched overboard. In some cases, some of the more deplorable cases, people would die in their bunks and not be removed, and those below would be too sick. And so there would be bodies of people who had perished next to those who were living. And there were incredibly gruesome accounts of these ships in ports, for instance, at the quarantine station of Gros Isle in Canada, where they would be launching bodies overboard, and then they would just be floating there. And the horrific stories of those people who witnessed it are really quite chilling to read.
Now, tell us about the Jeannie Johnston.
Well, the remarkable Jeannie Johnston managed to do what none of these other ships could do, and that is keep all of her passengers alive. And there's a really wonderful confluence of events that led to this, and the book details these in great detail. But the short answer is, beginning with her shipbuilder, who was an incredibly philanthropic man in Quebec, who built the ship as an act of philanthropy. He didn't have a buyer for the ship. He financed it with its own money. And unlike other ships, which had been these tired old timber haulers that were decades old, the Jeannie Johnston was brand new. As far as we can tell, we think that John Munn, the shipbuilder, knew that it was going to be an Irish famine ship because he built the area below deck quite unique for a timber hauler. It's much taller above deck. A grown man could walk about, which made it very different. Mm-hmm. And it was an unusually sound vessel. It received the Lloyd's of London highest rating for a ship. He sent it over to London, still without a buyer. And by his reputation alone, he was able to sell it to Nicholas Donovan, the owner of the ship. And Donovan was a very enterprising man. He doesn't always come across very favorably in the book. Unlike Munn, he was very motivated by his reputation and by his desire to become successful within town. But that motivation led him to want very much for his ship to be a success. He knew he'd be able to advertise for higher passage rates. He knew that he would get, and in fact, he did get, a great deal of very favorable publicity for the safety of his ship. And he hired two very remarkable men, I think two of the most interesting characters in the book, and that is James Attridge, the captain, and Richard Blennerhassett, the doctor. And their combined qualities of commitment to safety, incredibly humanitarian-minded decisions, and in Richard Blennerhassett's cases, very forward-looking ideas about contagious diseases meant they could do what no one else could.
Mm-hmm. Okay. In the interest of full disclosure, my Dr. Richard Blennerhassett, many generations after the famous Dr. Richard Blennerhassett. And he is the father of a grandniece and grandnephew of mine. And we do know that the Blennerhassets of Tralee and that area down there were considered as, again, very charitable and extremely well qualified at the time. Have you researched why or how the Dr. Blennerhassett at that time would take such enormous risk himself, not just on one occasion, but on several occasions, and actually be on board?
Well, as you mentioned, the family was known and is still known for their incredibly charitable social awareness. And his father, who served as one of the doctors at the fever hospitals, indeed dedicated his life to famine sufferers as well. And Richard Blennerhassett was educated at Edinburgh, the best medical school in the world at the time. He had a very prestigious term where he studied midwifery in Dublin. And really, especially as someone who was a member of the landed gentry, he could have picked any career he wanted and certainly could have picked a very comfortable job as a general practitioner. But he had this sense of service and duty that had been instilled in him from his father and grandfather. And immediately after graduating from medical school, he joined a ship full of Indian indentured servants on their way to South America. He witnessed gross cholera death rates aboard this ship. He had to single-handedly manage both the living and the dead. And that experience so marked in him the severity of the situation that he dedicated the rest of his life to this cause and very shortly thereafter joined the Jeannie Johnston.
Friends, my guest is Catherine Miles, and she is the author of a just-released new book called All Standing, and it is the remarkable story of the Jeannie Johnston, the legendary Irish famine ship. It is published by Simon & Schuster. Let me ask you about another character in your book, and indeed one of the central characters, Nicholas Riley. Who is he?
Nicholas Riley is one of my favorite characters in the book. He was born on Easter Sunday, just as the ship was about to embark upon its first voyage with passengers. His parents were farmers outside of Tralee, and they had also a son who was about a year old at the time. And his mother, Margaret, was 9 months pregnant when she stepped aboard, which was a tremendous risk given these mortality rates.
And, yes.
She went into labor the night before they were about to depart, and just as the sun rose on Easter Sunday, gave birth with the help of the captain, the doctor, and the crew of the Jeannie Johnston to this healthy baby boy. And she was so touched by the kindness and the generosity that had been shown by the crew, that she, in fact, gave Nicholas 18 middle names, one for each member of the crew.
Wow.
And they abbreviated that for convenience sake as JJ. So he's always listed on governmental documents as Nicholas JJ Riley. He survived the trip to North America, and he became, I think, in a lot of ways, the emblem of the quest for the American dream. And through a little bit of luck and research, I was able to trace his family heritage to his living descendants. And with their help, I was able to tell the story of how he came to be a successful businessman in America.
Now, where did he wind up, and how did he get there?
That's a very long and wonderful story, too. But again, and I detail it in a lot of the chapters in the book, but the short answer is they were part of a chain migration, which was very common at this time, where people would go and settle where other family members or other community members had already settled.
Mm-hmm.
And that took him originally to the wonderfully named town of Liberty, Indiana, where his father worked on the railroad. But it was very dangerous, very hard work, and he was a farmer, and that's what he wanted to remain. So he soon resettled the family to Michigan. And then through a wonderfully complicated series of events, including a con artist brother-in-law, Nicholas eventually ended up in Minnesota, finally settling in Minneapolis. where he was the owner of a very successful pub.
Now, there is, and you go out of your way to point out that there is an historical context of the ship's journey to mirror current world problems. How did you either arrive at that, or what part does that play in your book, All Standing?
I think it plays less of a direct role in the book, but I think readers will see, in some cases, disturbing similarities, what was happening at this time, which is, you know, the 1840s, and what's happening now. The world was at a moment of great transition and tipping points. There was a peak energy scare, but instead of the peak oil crisis that we're in now, mm-hmm. there was a peak timber crisis. There was a huge shift towards industrial agriculture and what we call monocropism. In that mm-hmm. case, it was the potato. In our case, it's corn and soybeans. There was newfound fear of these mass pandemics and seemingly untreatable flus. And then there was also a great deal of concern over how to handle immigration and what mm-hmm. that meant to national identity. And these are all things that I think you'll see in the headlines every day when you open up the news.
Absolutely, and particularly with regards to immigration, which hopefully, fingers crossed and touching wood, will be addressed this year, and hopefully sooner rather than later. What do you expect readers to take away from your book, All Standing?
Well, when I was telling the story, I was very much struck by the strength of the narrative of the people and the characters who lived in it. And I see in them, and what touches me the most, is this sense of struggle and this willingness to put so much on the line. And as I was writing the book, I kept asking, why? Why was this ship different? And why were these people willing to take risks that no one else was? Was it heroism? Was it an attempt to sort of advance their own self-prestige? Was it villainy? What was it? And I think that those questions will resonate for the readers, too. And I think they may be surprised by some of the answers. I think there's a lot to say, too, about the sense of hope and perseverance.
Yeah.
And most importantly, I think the fact that while the United States is incredibly diverse and very much the melting pot that it states that it is, the one thing that unites all of us is that we all have some immigrant story about how it is that our family got here. And while this is first and foremost a book about an Irish family who got here, their story is also in some very profound ways the story that all of us share here in America and beyond.
Nicholas Donovan, another character.
Yes, good guy and bad guy.
Yeah.
Very interesting figure. You know, this was right when Catholics in Ireland had only reached a state of enfranchisement. So he was the first generation of Catholics in Ireland who could hold land, who could vote, who could hold office. He lived in a town that was not at all happy about this. There was a quote in the local paper when he was asked to join the grand jury that they were now going to be a grand jury run by nothing better than shopkeepers, even though he was the town's most successful importer and exporter. But he wanted to be a self-made man, and he wanted to be a man to be reckoned with, and he had a variety of schemes. And luckily, one of these schemes was the success of the Jeannie Johnston.
Yeah. And the captain, Attridge, where was he actually from?
He was from Cork, and he was the first Irish captain owner of a tall ship in Ireland. So he had already made history doing what no other Irishman had done. He was also Nicholas Donovan's cousin. And he okay. had, from the start, an impeccable record of following marine law. And they said that no one was more strict and benevolent at the same time than James Attridge. He never received a single citation for anything, which was unheard of at that time. And when Nicholas Donovan had serious mission that he needed to send a captain out on, he always chose James Attridge. And so when he bought the Jeannie Johnston, he approached his cousin and asked him if he would take over as captain of the ship. And he did. And some of the immigrants who sailed aboard would take the very last pennies and shillings to their name, and they would spend it on ads in newspapers raving about James Attridge's treatment and the conditions on board.
Now, you're a sailor yourself. You like to sail. Tell us about Belfast, Maine, and up in your neck of the woods there. What is the connection, and is there a strong connection there with the voyages and the many ships, particularly during that in the mid 19th century there? And what is the connection there?
Well, Belfast has had a strong connection to Ireland since its founding, and as I mentioned, it was founded by Scots-Irish who came over to look for a place to farm and settle, and that sense of continuity has continued. We have one of the largest Celtic celebrations in New England here every year, and it is very much a sailing city. It had a very large rum refinery here in the 19th century, and it was part of that triangle trade with the schooners. The Jeannie Johnston never docked here, but one of my favorite stories about the Jeannie Johnston is this very harrowing tale where a group of Jeannie immigrants landed in a storm unexpectedly in New Brunswick. They were unable to find work, and they had to hike from New Brunswick down along the coast of Maine in the middle of winter to get down to Portland, where they hope to find passage beyond. And the thought of them walking in very thin clothes on a winter day like the one we're having today is pretty remarkable.
And now, the Jeannie Johnston itself and the replica of the original ship, I know a little about it because on the first fundraiser on this side of the Atlantic anyway, that was initiated by Dick Spring, who was the Taoiseach, the Deputy Prime Minister from Ireland at the time in the coalition government. And the objective of building this famine ship, which I suppose in conversion rates at this point would have cost somewhere in the area of $30+ million dollars, but the initiative was based on, even though this was before or at the beginning of the peace process in Northern Ireland, it was justified by attracting and bringing a great number of those interested in the building in shipbuilding, and bringing them, many of them from Northern Ireland, and indeed from areas throughout Europe in particular, to bring them to Tralee to build, again, an exact replica of the Jeannie Johnston, and actually right, except for the, obviously, the mechanics. The ship itself was this replica, and it was indeed in the 90s when it was in Tralee. We did more than probably two or three programs, radio programs, from the ship itself when it was docked in Tralee. And we saw many of us on this side, particularly in New York and on the East Coast here, who had gone for numerous reasons to Tralee. We actually witnessed the building of this ship, and it absolutely seemed like this was incredible, that ships like this could have been built without the advantages of all the electronic equipment and all of the modern advantages of science. But to imagine that this was actually a ship like this was built 150 years prior was indeed a marvel in itself.
It is a very much a marvel, and not one without controversy, too. The recreation, I think, was doomed to controversy from the start.
Oh, yeah.
You mentioned the recreation in terms of its accuracy, and there's a wonderfully detailed survey of the original ship available in Greenwich, England, which was used. But unfortunately, Coast Guard specifications deemed that the ship was no longer seaworthy, and so they had to take some liberties in terms of its size, especially regarding its mast, and that outraged some people in the wooden boat community.
Yeah.
The budget, as you know, outraged many in Ireland. But what did become of it, and I think this is the most important thing, is this incredible testimony to a very important moment in both Irish and American history, and one that is still docked in Dublin for all to see.
Right. And indeed, I was among those who, when it was being transported from Tralee across the lake to, and the name of the place escapes me for the moment, but that was done actually with the assistance of tugboats, and it was a very historic a trip. That's as far as I got in the Jeannie Johnson. But actually, when it was about to become a museum and to bring on what was then, it quelled some of the criticism and the controversy when it was brought to Dublin, where it is docked at the Custom House and the quays in Dublin's city centre. You actually, at that time, you went and you did your own spin on the Jeannie Johnston.
I did. I like to think of it as method acting. I joined as apprentice crew. I was overwhelmed with the generosity of the crew who were serving aboard. They took a great deal of time to make me acclimated on the ship. We encountered our fair share of storms.
Yeah.
So I got a little taste of what it is to feel very seasick below deck. But it was a really remarkable journey. And,
right.
And without it, I don't think I would have been able to tell the story of the ship in the amount of detail that I was able to.
Well, you've definitely told it. Of course, it did come to New York, and it was here for a relatively short period of time. It went up along the East Coast, and it one of the most remarkable aspects of it was, despite the modifications that had to be made in order to make it seaworthy, across the Atlantic, was the first-hand experience of, if this were the best of, you know, of thousands of the ships that crossed the Atlantic in bringing the famine victims to North America, one would have to shudder to think of what the others were like, because it whereas it would have been, this was a very special ship and the cliche, an upmarket ship, it definitely lacked, in our opinion, you know, some of the what we might expect at the time. You mentioned on the coffin ships or on those ships crossing the Atlantic, there were no basic facilities for sanitation, no toilets, no anything. And how much that contributed to the mortality rate definitely is again just it is extraordinarily difficult to understand why some kind of, you know, facilities such as, if only for sanitary reasons, that wasn't an accommodation at all, but it underlines the fact that these were not passenger ships in the first place.
No, and some of them were so unseaworthy that they would literally disintegrate in the middle of the ocean and everyone would drown. To further complicate matters, British law required the captains to provide each passenger with a pound of either oatmeal or cornmeal or flour a day, which is hardly enough calories for even a healthy person to subsist. But furthermore, many of these rations were moldy or unfit for human consumption, or the passengers were not allowed the opportunity to cook it above deck.
Right.
There was also...
And it was done with water. There was no... this was a meal like a... somewhat like a corn meal that at best would have been, you know, very crude and barely digestible.
That's right. And even on the very good ships, most passengers were allowed one time a day to come up aboard and cook the family meal for the day on these very crude cook stoves, which were really just some cinder blocks set up with a fire inside. The only water they were given was just enough to cook the meal. It wasn't enough to wash or bathe or anything like that. And then there was this prevailing notion at the time that fresh air spread disease. And so the passengers would be locked below in the hold with no fresh air in these deplorable conditions. And it's no wonder that major diseases and contagions would break out in these incredibly horrific rates down below. And that was one of the things that was the most interesting to me about Richard Blennerhassett, was he did not, in spite of the fact that he was criticized for it at the time, he did not subscribe to this fresh air theory. He insisted that the passengers on board the Jeannie Johnston get fresh air, that they were allowed to air out their linens. And he was willing to take a stand about contagious diseases that very few other doctors at the time were willing to do.
What about the manifest and how, in your own research, what did you find? I mean, basically, in theory anyway, it only made 11 round trips to North America.
That's right, it did. And I was able to find nearly all of the manifests in the National Archives over in Kew outside of London. And that was one of the most remarkable parts of research for the entire project for me, was being able to see these manifests written in Attridge's hand. He would make notes on the back of them about the trips. And so with that information in hand, I was able to do a variety of different types of research in Ireland, in Canada, and then in the United States. And through these different data points, I was able to piece together the entire story of the ship. I also had tremendous help from historians, including Helen O'Carroll, who is the curator of the Kerry County Museum and an excellent
yes.
wealth of information on the ship.
Yes, and, you know, we've met her on many occasions as well. It's a great book, and it has been extremely well reviewed. Hard to accept that it is a novel, because your research is such that I think history will record that this is indeed going to have its place of honor, and well it should, because your own research has brought us as close as we can get to the history of the famous Jeannie Johnston, and indeed we might add to that, for those who are heading for Ireland, particularly in this year, the year of the gathering in Ireland, that this Jeannie Johnston again is docked, and it's open for visitors and tours. So, and it's well worth seeing. It's the wooden tall ship of again a replica of the Jeannie Johnston herself, and it's tremendous, and it has music, and it has it's definitely one of the great experiences that one can have, and one of the few opportunities that indeed anybody will have to an historical and archaeological overview of not only the famine era, but the there is, for instance, a maritime lecture series which takes place, and it is the ship itself is magnificent, but perhaps all the more reason why your book is being and your research is being reviewed in such a very positive manner. We want to congratulate you on it, and again to tell those, and let the word spread forth, that the book is called All Standing. By the way, just how did you come up with the title? And for what's
it's
the significance?
It's a nautical term, and it has a variety of meanings, but it means to be at the ready at all times, and I thought that was a great testament to the people on board.
Great. Catherine Miles, good luck to you with your book. It is published by Simon & Schuster. And for information, of course, you can go to www.simonandschuster.com. And again, we will no doubt, when the weather warms up and when you're on your book tour, we look forward to welcome you down to our area down here. And again, good luck to you. It's great. It's marvelous.
Thank you so much, and thanks for having me today.
Okay. Friends, again, the book All Standing. Our guest, Catherine Miles, Simon & Schuster. You're listening to Irish Radio Network USA, the Flannelly Show, live from New York.